way all along. Well, the kicking out of Earl Browder was one of the biggest mistakes that the party ever made. As a matter of fact, it helped to dig its own grave when it did that. But you see, many of us thought in the years that we belonged to the Communist Party, later on.
Mr. Gates, is there any doubt in your mind that the American Communist Party, over the period of the 27 years when you were in the party, followed every twist and turn of the Soviet Communist Party? You suggest that there is freedom involved if they follow the communist line as set up by a foreign power.
Well, you see, you have to understand how and why it followed that line. It's not a matter that someone gave orders over there and we followed it over here. It's much more subtle than that. We followed that line because we thought it was right. It's more or less like a relationship between two people. One is an aggressive, brilliant personality, and the other worships that person, and that person becomes sort of an idol for him, and he tends to imitate and ape everything that he does.
But you're
that kind of relationship is a bad relationship for both people.
Certainly not a free relationship.
Certainly not.
No. Well, now, answer again this question. Why did it take you, John Gates, 27 years to get fed up with a group that destroyed freedom and dignity, the Communist Party of the United States? Why 27 years?
Because in those 27 years, I and the Communist Party did a great deal to uphold the freedom and dignity. When I joined in 1931, as you said before, that was in the midst of a depression, the biggest one this country ever had. Nobody had any answers to what to do. The country was in a panic. The only people that seemed to me to have any kind of solution were the communists. And not only did they have a solution, but they did things. And I joined because of that, and I began to do things too. I went to Youngstown, Ohio, when I was 19. I left college, I left home. I didn't know where I was going to live. I didn't know how I was going to live. I hadn't a penny in my pocket. But I went there to organize the unemployed. I went there to try to organize the steel workers into an industrial union. A few years later, I volunteered to fight in Spain against fascism. A couple of years after that, I volunteered in World War II. A week after Pearl Harbor. Well, these were good things that the party did.
No, these were good things that in your mind, you volunteered to join the American Armed Forces, and yet they didn't have to be communists to do it. And the fact of the matter is, isn't it, Mr. Gates, this is what I'm trying to understand, that in, you were after a certain end, an understandable end, but the means that you employed to achieve that end were bent upon destroying the very American heritage of freedom, which is the most important thing that we possess in this country.
Well, again, that's a contradictory question, because we did things to uphold American traditions of freedom, and we also did things to destroy them. For example, we pioneered. You said everybody did these things that we did, but that wasn't true in 1931.
I said a good many of us.
That's true. In 1931, there was a kind of a vacuum in the country which we filled. We stepped into this vacuum.
You partially filled.
That's true, I would say.
And you were certainly in the minority even then.
But on this question of freedom,
yes.
For example. Well, the Communist Party, 1931, was one of the first organizations in this country to dramatize the whole issue of civil rights for the Negro people, equal citizenship. And that certainly was upholding the traditions of American freedom, American democracy. Now, in doing that, we did a lot of other things which tended to destroy all the good things that we did.
On that,
and finally discredited us amongst the American people.
That's the point of why, what I'm trying to find out if I can, is why you, and why so many thousands of others, fail to understand that in doing those things, you are destroying the bulwark of America, which is its freedom. Why did it take you as long as it did? That is what I'm trying to understand.
It took me a long time, it took me 27 years, because in those 27 years, we did a great deal to uphold American democracy and to advance.
It begins to sound, sir, it begins to sound a little bit like a broken record playing and playing. Tell me this, in a sense, your story is similar to that of the novelist Howard Bass, who quit the party last year. Is Bass a man whom you respect?
I admire him as a writer, and I admire him as a person, even though I disagree with some of the things that he said and done.
Well, in your
thing, he's an honest man.
You think he's an honest?
Yes.
In his new book, The Naked God, Howard Bass writes this about what it takes to be a leader in the Communist Party. He says this, quote, "He must be driven by a lust for power, for there are few other rewards for party leadership. Power, he says, is the drug, the spur, and the goal." And he goes on to say, "Power-hungry, dictatorial, inhuman, and anti-human," he calls communist leaders, "in no matter what country." Could it be that you simply stayed in the party because you crave the sense of power, of importance?
No, I don't think so, and that's one of the things I disagree with Mr. Fast on. I don't think it's a question of power. I think that what kept people in the Communist Party was something much more important and fundamental than that. When I sacrificed my life, including going to two wars and going to jail, that wasn't a question of power. I could probably have made a lot more money working somewhere outside the Communist Party than I made inside the Communist Party.
How much, as editor of the Daily Worker, did you make in take-home pay, if I may ask?
My average take-home pay was $65 a week.
For the past 5 years?
That's right.
$65 a week?
That's right.
A competent newspaper man, editor.
Well, people may have their own opinions as to how competent I was.
And yet you were willing, for what you conceived to be an ideal, to work for that kind of money. You say you didn't want power. Is it possible that you were just caught up in the apparatus, that you were on a treadmill and you didn't know how to get out?
No, I got out when I wanted to get out and when I thought it was necessary to get out. Nobody forced me to, and I wasn't compelled to.
You see, what I'm trying to find out is a little bit of the history, American history, of the past 25 years. Why some men got in, why they stayed in as long, how they could have been as wrong as you now confess yourself to have been, but why it took you as long as you did to get out. The distinguished American psychiatrist, Robert Lindner, wrote this about American communists. He said, "With the tenacity of faith recalling the passion of Hebrew prophets and Christian martyrs, they believed. Even in the face of brutal reality, the belief of these many remains unshaken." So what he does, in a sense, is liken communism to a religion. Was it for you a religion? Is it for people who still remain within the party, that kind of a faith?
It is, in a sense, a kind of faith like that, and especially in the sense that it is an unshaken faith. That's one of the things that helped the Communist Party go down the drain. And that is that although it contributed a great deal in the past 25 years to change America, it was unable to change itself and lost touch with American reality. It kept believing in things that it was no longer possible to believe in.
I know, and they keep coming back. The Democratic Party, the Republican Party, Norman Thomas and socialists also have contributed to the progress of America for the past 25 years. But none of these people found it necessary, none of these groups found it necessary to abridge our freedom. And you preach the abridgment of freedom.
Oh, not at all. Never preached the abridgment of American freedoms.
That's why you're out of the party right now. Let me ask you this. There are skeptics here in New York, particularly, skeptics who say John Gates has left the Communist Party now because he had a bitter factional fight with the Foster Group, the William Z. Foster Group, and he left really for very personal, factional reasons, rather than because he is really sick to death and fed up with communism. How do you react to that?
It's true that it was a bitter fight, but behind that bitter fight were not personal reasons, primarily. There were political reasons. And it had to do with the relationship between the American communists and communists abroad, especially communists of the Soviet Union. The admiration that I spoke of before, that the communists had of the Soviet Union for the last 25 years finally resulted in alienating the American communists from the American people.
I think you're making it sound a little too simple, sir. You wrote in your series for the New York Post, which will appear next week, that when you were in the Communist Party, you worked for a Soviet system in the United States. That's a quote from you. You admit that for years you doggedly followed the Soviet-Russian line. Now, think for an instant, if you and the rest of you had had your way, would not the United States now be a dictatorship or a satellite country? Wouldn't we all be living in fear, without freedom, without dignity?
Yes, if we had had our way in 1931, that would have been the case.
Well, for 25 years after that.
And the point I'm trying to make is that something happened in this party in the last 2 years. And a convention took place a year ago, which constituted a break from that kind of policy.
You pointed that out before.
But something has happened since that convention, which has resulted in the betrayal of that new program.
Let me ask you this. Please, maybe it's an oversimple question, but I would like a straight answer. What is bad about communism?
What is bad about communism as it has been practiced so far is that it does not have democracy. What is good about it?
I'm not asking.
Well, I want to tell you what's good about it, because then you can't understand what's bad about it and why I still believe in socialism. What's good about it is the fact that production is for use, and it's planned, and is not held by private owners who operate the economy on behalf of a few.
Well, we understand that, and these are the aspirations of the socialists, led by Norman Thomas, a good American, a respected American, who found that he could achieve his aims, he believed, through the ballot rather than the bullet. So in a sense, that is the difference between communism and socialism. That is what is bad about communism. And yet you seem reluctant. You appear to me as a man...
I'm not reluctant at all. That's why I quit the Communist Party. And I've been very vigorous in presenting my views on this for the last 2 years. Publicly.
There are 5,000 to 8,000 communists left in the party in the United States, we're told. Who are these people in the rank and file? And what I mean by that is, where do they live mostly in the United States? What economic professional groups do they come from?
About half of the present membership of the Communist Party is in New York City. Most of the others are in Chicago, California.
What professional groups?
I would say half of them are workers, and half of them are housewives.
People of moderate or low income?
Moderate, I would say.
And I understand that there are very few young people. You're 44, and you're one of the youngest members, I understand.
There are almost no young people in the party today, and very few even at my age level. The age level is in the late 50s. Nobody is coming into the party, so that the party is getting older, dying.
For those diehards who remain devoted party members even now, those who still look to the Soviet Union as utopia, suppose the United States and Russia went to war, is it not reasonable to assume that those diehards would remain loyal to Russia?
I'd like to answer that first by saying that it wouldn't make any difference what they would do if war broke out between the United States and Russia.
That we understand, but that's not the question.
I don't think you understand that. It would be too late.
Well, I understand that.
Because once war broke out between the United States and the Soviet Union, within a few minutes, you and I, and most other Americans, and for that matter, humanity, might not be alive.
But where would their loyalty be?
Nobody would be in a position to debate or talk about such things.
Where would their loyalty be?
I don't know where their loyalty would be. I know where my loyalty would be.
Where would your loyalty be?
My loyalty in any war of aggression against the United States of America would always be with the United States.
What if the United States were to go to the aid of a small country, one of our allies, which had been attacked? Let's say that we decided to go to the defense of Hungary. Where would your loyalty be?
If we went to the defense of a country which was the victim of aggression, my loyalty would be with the United States.
Do you feel that Hungary was the victim of aggression by Mr. Khrushchev and his troops?
My newspaper, The Daily Worker, when I was the editor of it, condemned the armed intervention of the Soviet Union in Hungary, although at the same time we opposed the use that John Foster Dulles was trying to make of that in order to destroy socialism in Hungary.
I ask you now, was Hungary the victim of aggression? Just a yes or no?
Yes, it was.
John Gates, in just a moment I'm going to ask you how you feel about yourself today after giving your adult life to a swindle that still would seem to justify deceit and murder in place of dignity and freedom. Do you consider that you were a traitor, a dupe, or possibly a kind of tragic fool? We'll get the answer to that question in just 60 seconds.
From the nation's leading independent research laboratory comes this important announcement. The first filter cigarette in the world that meets the standards of the United States Testing Company. Parliament, with a new high-filtration filter.
This is the cigarette, Parliament. And these are the facts, proved. In Parliament, over 30,000 traps. The most effective filtering material in a cigarette today. No other popular cigarette delivers less tar and nicotine. Proved in Parliament, the exclusive recessed filter holds trapped tar and nicotine away from your lips. There's no leakage from filter to mouth. Proved in Parliament, the most complete filtering action in cigarette history. And the flavor story is simple. More expensive tobaccos bring you the friendly satisfaction that cigarettes were invented for.
The filtering findings you have just seen are certified true by the United States Testing Company. Parliament, now at popular price.
That's the Parliament story, the most complete filtering action in cigarette history. Try Parliament yourself. John Gates, how do you feel about yourself today after giving your entire adult life to communism? Do you consider that you were a traitor to the United States? A dupe? Or possibly do you consider yourself a kind of a tragically foolish?
I don't consider myself any one of those things. I am not ashamed of my 27 years in the Communist Party. I'm not ashamed of what I did in 1931 to help bring unemployment and social insurance to this country, or my fight in Spain against fascism, or my fight in World War II. I'm proud of those things. I am deeply ashamed of many of the mistakes that I made and that the party made. But we made those mistakes thinking that we were doing those things in the interest of America.
As you know, in the past, we've interviewed Earl Browder, who was thrown out of the party, excommunicated back in 1945 for preaching against the Soviet line. When we talked with Mr. Browder, we got the picture of a man who seemed to be trying to convince himself that he, too, had been right all along and that he had made some mistakes, but that, all in all, he'd been a good American. Isn't that really what you're trying to do yourself? Are you not proving yourself unwilling, in a sense, I certainly don't mean to preach, but unwilling to really confess your errors?
Not at all. On the contrary, I think that the mistakes that I have made and that the party have made have been so big that it has resulted in the death of the Communist Party, and that's why I quit it. And that's why I'm trying to do something new and different.
Did you ever go to Russia?
No, I've never been in the Soviet Union.
Were you never invited?
No.
You had no particular yen to go there?
Yes, I would have liked to have gone, but somehow or other, the opportunity never presented itself.
How do you think American communists have been regarded by Russia, particularly? How do you think they are regarded by the Soviet Communist Party now?
I don't think the Soviet communists understand American communists. Well, for that matter, Americans in general.
Do you think they value their communist comrades here?
I think they don't value the right things about them. And for that reason, they threw their weight behind those people in the party who have really resulted in the destruction of the party.
There are 7,000-8,000 communists left in the party here. How do we get them out?
I can only think of one thing that's more futile than belonging to the Communist Party, and that is to devote one's life to getting people out of the Communist Party. I'm not going to do that. And for that matter, I don't have to, nor does anybody else have to, because the Communist Party is doing such a good job of destroying itself. It doesn't need any help from anybody else. The best thing to do is let it alone, and it'll die. However, I'd like to add another point on that, and that is that it's peculiar that as McCarthyism declined in this country and freedom expanded, that is at this moment that people began to leave the Communist Party more than during the height of the repression against it. So I would say the best way to handle communism is to expand freedom.
To expand freedom.
In our country and in the world.
They seem to be sensible, if somewhat paradoxical words, coming from a man who spent 27 years in the Communist Party, but maybe you would understand better than all of us how valuable freedom is. What kind of a place now, for a final question, what kind of a place do you think there is for you, John Gibbs, in American life?
I think there is a place. From the reaction to my quitting the party, I know there is a place. I want to talk to people, find out what they want to do before I decide what I want to do. I want to devote my life to freeing from prison two of my former colleagues, Gil Green and Henry Winston, who are still there for the false charge of advocating the overthrow of the government by force and violence. I want to fight John Foster Dulles. I want to fight against the Cold War. I didn't quit the party in order to switch on those things.
John Gates, I thank you for coming and spending this half hour.
On the stagecoach. The food the passenger received at the way station was no pleasanter than the road he traveled. The noon stop was best. Then the stagecoach traveler enjoyed bacon, baked potato, biscuits, and tea, for which the traveler was expected to pay a dollar and a half, quite a sum in those early days. But if the stage were late, if night had fallen, if the way station were small, then, well, it was like this.
Colonel, now there was a real riot. Every blasted bone in my blasted body feels like a toothache.
Well, I hope there's food in this pest hole. Doesn't look too promising, does it?
I'd say, matter of fact, it looks downright discouraging.
But by the 1860s, there were stagecoach lines reaching to nearly every community in Minnesota, regardless of dust, mud, jouncing, late schedules, and poor food. And at last, when the railroad spread across the land in the 1870s and 1880s, the stagecoach lines dwindled and died.
Yes, the Red River ox carts were important. The stagecoach was important. But the 1850s and 60s were the golden era of the steamboat. In 1850, there were only a few more than 6,000 people in Minnesota. 10 years later, the population had increased to 170,000. And the gain? It was due chiefly to the now large stern-wheelers and side-wheelers that crowded the St. Paul levee every day during the navigation season. As late as 1853, St. Paul was only a small town, St. Anthony, but a village. But by 1860, both towns had doubled, tripled, and then quadrupled in size. Frequently, there were as many as 20 steamboats lined up at the St. Paul levee at the same time. And a St. Paul editor wrote in 1854,
"We predicted there would be a great increase in the business of this city, as well as an unprecedented immigration to the territory at the opening of navigation this spring. But we will candidly admit that we did not expect so perfect a rush as has set in upon us. Every boat comes crowded with freight and passengers. Storage on the levee is double what it was at this time last year, and new warehouses are building."
And in 1860, in the spring, before the navigation season opened, it was estimated that there were 200,000 bushels of grain stored, awaiting shipment to La Crosse, where the railroad from Chicago already reached the river. And the steamers, smaller ones, plied the rivers, up the Minnesota to New Ulm, as far as Redwood Falls, up the Mississippi, above St. Anthony Falls, along the St. Croix. And one vessel, the Anson Northrop, was dismantled, carried piece by piece along the Red River Oxcart Trail, was reassembled and put into service on the Red River of the North. Then, in September 1861, another Minnesota milestone. The steamer Alhambra tied up at the St. Paul levee. On a barge was a new kind of engine, the first in Minnesota, the William Cooks. It was ironic, perhaps, that a steamboat should bring upriver the first railroad engine, the iron horse that would shortly put it out of business. But having arrived, there was nothing for the Cooks to do. The rails were not yet laid, and there were no cars for it to pull. But the following spring, the coaches arrived on barges from downriver, and on June 28, 1862, the William Cooks was hitched to its garishly painted coaches and made the first railroad journey in Minnesota. Round trip from St. Paul to St. Anthony, now Minneapolis. Governor Edmund Rice was there, Lieutenant Governor Ignatius Donnelly, the mayors of St. Paul and St. Anthony. The chuffing engine stampeded the ponies of the Indians who had gathered along the new rail line to see their first iron horse. On July 2nd, 1862, the William Cooks began regular service. Four trips a day, each way. The fare, 60 cents. But it was back in the 1840s that public clamor arose for railroads in Minnesota, the clamor coming from farmers, among others. Farmers objected to hauling their wheat by ox cart to the nearest river terminal, 100 miles or more. Before 1858, no one believed that Minnesota would ever amount to anything more than a raw wilderness. But in that year, it was suddenly driven home that Minnesota had become a wheat-exporting state, one of the nation's big wheat producers. And the public clamor for railroads grew louder and louder. So no wonder then that the William Cooks was greeted with such enthusiasm when it made its first appearance in the spring of 1862. And now railroad buildings spurted, thin ribbons of steel stretching across the land with amazing speed. One year later, there were 46 miles of railroad in Minnesota. 2 years later, 210 miles of track. By 1867, Minnesota was connected directly to Chicago. By the end of 1872, 15 railway companies had constructed almost 2,000 miles of railroad in the state. By 1880, Minnesota's basic railroad system, as we know it today, had been completed. There remained only the task of constructing feeder lines. Minnesota was covered by a network of 3,100 miles of railroad reaching into nearly every town. Settlers came by the thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands. Minnesota's population had grown to 780,000 by 1880. The golden age of the railroads in Minnesota had begun.
And now, James J. Hill. His name is the name that towers above the Minnesota transportation story like Pike's Peak. James J. Hill, the man who is both loved and hated, sainted and feared. James J. Hill, the man who created a productive country, not only from a wilderness in Minnesota, but from a wilderness that extended all the way to the Pacific Ocean. James J. Hill, a hardworking man, a Canadian who came to Minnesota to the raw frontier. He sold one of Minnesota's first threshing machines, handled the first shipment of Minnesota-grown wheat. In his job as a shipping clerk, he cut a stencil for the label on the first barrel of Minnesota milled flour. James J. Hill obtained control of the bankrupt St. Paul and Pacific Railroad in the year 1878 and reorganized it as the St. Paul, Minneapolis, and Manitoba. He pushed out his railroad lines and then brought in the farmers to settle on his land. He built towns, encouraged agriculture, improved livestock. James J. Hill's money went to libraries and to churches. And though a Protestant, he gave $1 million to build a Catholic seminary. James Jerome Hill, referred to as the Empire Builder, was called other names too. He was variously known as the man who made the Northwest, the man who wrecked the Northwest, the scourge of Minnesota and the Dakotas, the curse of Montana. Homesteaders brought to Minnesota on Jim Hill's railroad with Hill's money named a particularly offensive weed Jim Hill mustard. The settlers in the Red River Valley had a saying that went, "After the grasshoppers, we had Jim Hill." And then in 1883, another mighty milestone in the history of Minnesota, the Northern Pacific Railroad became the second railroad to reach the Pacific Ocean. And such rejoicing. St. Paul was decked out as it never has been decked out before or since. The streets were covered with elaborate arches, making it look more like the Arabian Nights than a town known as Pigseye. On Wabasha Street, there was an arch with a good-sized Chinese pagoda atop it. A banner proclaimed the Northern Pacific was the connecting link between St. Paul and China. Accounts of the day tell us there were blushing maidens strewing the streets with flowers. And in a 70-degree temperature that September 3rd, a 15-mile-long parade wound through St. Paul. It took 5 hours to pass any given point, had 725 decorated wagons, and 4,300 participants. That afternoon, four special trains came chugging into St. Paul from the west. Aboard were President Chester A. Arthur, former President Grant, cabinet members, governors, senators, ambassadors, congressmen, state officials, mayors, railroad officials, plus even a delegation of Indians. That evening, there was a banquet in the luxurious Hotel Lafayette on Lake Minnetonka. Mayor C.D. O'Brien of St. Paul arose.
Gentlemen, our banquet has been unexpectedly graced by the presence of His Excellency, the President of the United States. I have the honor to propose the health of President Arthur, the President of the United States, to be drank standing. Mr. Mayor and gentlemen, I thank you cordially for your kind greeting. I am glad to take part with you in these festivities. The great work, the accomplishment of which they seek to commemorate, may well be celebrated with joy and thanksgiving. And Mr. Mayor, well may your beautiful and thriving city and her sister municipality, standing as they do at the gateway of this new high road of commerce which stretches far out to sea, congratulate themselves that they enter today upon a career of enlarged usefulness and prosperity.
There was more talk from the president and then lengthy speeches that went far, far into the small morning hours before the historic occasion was ended. The Great Northern pushed its tracks to the Pacific in 1893, and the Milwaukee Road reached the Pacific in 1909. Then in 1912, James J. Hill retired as chairman of the board of one of the world's greatest railroad empires. On that occasion, he said,
"Nearly 40 years ago, the thought of a possible railway enterprise in the Northwest began to occupy my mind. It was born of experience in Northwestern transportation problems that had occupied most of my early business life, of faith in the productive powers and material resources of this part of the country, and of the railroad conditions at that time. After long and close study of the situation, the slender beginnings were made on which we risked our all. Failures would be immediate and final disaster. Most men who have really lived have had, in some shape, their great adventure. This railway is mine."
His wealth still contributes to the educational and cultural benefit of Minnesotans through the Hill Family Foundation. The railroad era continued after James J. Hill's death in 1916, and with Minnesota's 9,000 miles of railroads constructed, efforts were turned toward improving service. Railroad developments in this century have included air conditioning, speedier schedules, improved couplers, brakes, shock absorbers, allowing trains to travel at higher speeds with greater safety, and to meet increasing competition in the automobile era and the air age. And we have seen the change from the steam locomotive to the diesel, the thrilling, spine-tingling hoot-hoots of the steam locomotive speeding through the countryside has been replaced by the modern sound of the diesel, the bleat of the compressed air horn, and the roar of powerful motors. Yes, Minnesota's railroads have spanned the most rapid development in all our state's history. In spite of the abuses in the railroad era, the land grabbing, the swindles, the tycoons of industry squeezing the small investor. In spite of these, railroads have built Minnesota, have spanned the period of the most amazing growth in the history of the world. Yes, the flanged wheel on the steel rail will continue to play an important part in the history of Minnesota.
Thank you.
friends. This is Cedric Adams. It's my pleasure to talk with you at this time on behalf of a native Minnesota institution under whose sponsorship we bring you these centennial broadcasts. Twin City Federal, as a nationally outstanding savings institution, as the Northwest's leading home financing institution, Twin City Federal has contributed much to the progress of our state. Its record of sound, steady growth is a reflection of family hopes realized, family dreams of home ownership made real. During this past year, for example, more than 8,000 Minnesota families enjoyed new happiness in homes of their own through financing made available at Twin City Federal. At the same time, savings increased more than $23 million, the largest increase recorded by any Northwest savings institution. Families from all over our state enjoy progress through saving at Twin City Federal, the $250 million savings institution. And you're cordially invited to join them, where the twin clock flashes the time and the temperature in downtown Minneapolis and St. Paul.
And from Minneapolis and St. Paul, this is your Centennial Station, WCCO. Now here's Cedric.
Let's continue now with our story of transportation. Yes, there was the horse and buggy era. The old timers still call it with a tear of nostalgia the good old days. Horses, 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 crazy over horses. That's the way the old song went. If we could go back there now, we'd think the folks were crazy over horses. But that's not the way it was exactly. The horse was a way of life, like sleeping and eating and getting... The horse-drawn hearse carried the elderly citizen to his final resting place. And while the black-clad mourners dabbed their eyes, old Dobbin, with reins drooping and tail a-switching, nipped a few choice morsels for himself from the tall cemetery grass, with a few leaves from overhanging branches for dessert. And in between birth and death, the horse was not just a means of transportation, he was transportation. Most of what the maturing citizen ate was lugged home by the horse. The clothes on his back, the horse brought him from town. Buckboard in the summer, bobsled in the winter. To town and back, out around the farm, to the neighbors, off to Ma's and Pa's house, to town and back. Millions of hoof prints there in the dust, in the mud, and in the snow. It made no difference on the farm, in the country town, the county seat, the big city. It was the old hay burner who took you there. The hay burner that got you home again. The young man of yesterday was barely dry behind the ears when Pa took him in tow and taught him that necessary fact of life, all about hitching up the horse.
There, that's it, son. That's the martingale. Bring it up. No, no, no. Bring it under the belly. There, that's it. Now here, on the neck yoke. A hook to the britchen. Hey, you're doing fine, son. Fine. Hey, we'll make a teamster out of you yet.
And with the horse and buggy came that evil, that abomination. Many ladies still shudder at the word, the livery stable. Inevitably, our young citizen came home on a Saturday afternoon and ran right into the buzzsaw of Ma's wrath.
Oh, Ma, what did you hit me for?
You know what, sir. You've been down to that livery stable again, that's what, sir.
Oh, I was.
Yes, you were. Now, don't you lie to me, young'un. Mrs. Turner was just here and she seen you.
I told you
to keep away from that filthy place. When your Pa come home, I'm going to have him take the strop to you.
And Pa does come home and looks at Ma out of the corner of his eye. They've been all through this before, and he braces himself against a female blast of words that's cold as a winter's blast storm. Why is it she won't try to understand? He's tried to explain it. Everything she says is true. There is rough talk down at the livery stable, and some chewing and some cussing. The livery stable kept the horse and buggy era going. There, men talked about bloodlines and breeding. The foal out of such and such mare by such and such stallion. Ma hated and despised all that, but that's where her darling young'un went right after he had growed up a little. Talk about hot rodders and drag racing. The young man of the 1800s and early 1900s was the long sideburned young hoodlum of his day. He went to the livery stable and he picked out the highest, steppingest Morgan stallion he could find. He hitched it to the buggy with slender wheels, with spokes as fine as a girl's ankle. Its black and red gold finish he polished with loving care, and then off he went in a cloud of dust.
The idea was to turn the corner on two wheels at breakneck speed, driving a horse to a fury. And if the margin of daylight between the tree on the corner and an elderly citizen just crossing the street, if that margin was growing ever narrower, that just made it all the more fun.
Good young
whippersnapper! And there he stood, the elderly citizen, covered with dust, waving his cane in frustrated anger, still frightened by the demon horse, galloping past his nose, the roaring wheels, and the wide-toothed grin of the young idiot on the buggy. But did the young idiot care about that? You bet your sweet life he didn't. He did it again as he rattled up the drive to his girl's house, wheels jouncing, bouncing, rattling, reined his horse, and sprayed half a yard of gravel on the lawn. Oh, June, moon, croon, spoon, it's the lot of even the wildest of men, the young idiots, too. Fate decrees they shall be tamed by women.
Honey, honey, bless your heart.
And there, as the silvery moon glints its light from the water, the young lover, an idiot no longer, the young lover turns and watches the light and the shadows on the face of his beloved. The breeze ruffles the trees and sighs gently. Old Dobbin droops his head sleepily, ears twitching as though he's trying to catch a soft spoken word. And they talk of many things.
But, Johnny, I don't know. I really don't. Dad says you're wild and... Well, couldn't you try to act more, well, more like grown folks sometimes?
I guess I could. I mean, I know I could. But it's just that... Well, golly, why does everybody want me to go around acting like an old man or something? What's wrong with having a little fun? Well, I know. I guess your dad's right. All right.
Well... Maybe if I talk to Dad, and then, well, maybe if you talk to him, well, maybe it...
What I think you mean, do you? That is, will you? Shall we?
Yes, Johnny.
Well, you know what happened after that. They sealed it with another kiss in the buggy, and then came... At the little church. Then they were chivalried and they got in the buggy and went on their honeymoon. Ah, honeymoon. They went to live with her folks until Johnny could settle down and find a job and start earning some money. And many a person still alive remembers this frantic scene. Came tearing past at full gallop, foam at the mouth, eyes a-roll wildly, mane and tail flying in the breeze, buckboard bouncing, tipping crazily, swerving from this side to that. Dobbin either ran until he dropped from exhaustion or until one man, braver than the rest, dashed out, grabbed the reins, and to the acclaim of the throng, dragged Dobbin down at last. The horse-drawn car came in the 1870s. Some towns had mule-drawn streetcars. There were steam-drawn trains in the streets of St. Paul and Minneapolis, and then in the 1890s came the electric streetcar. It gave old Dobbin a good run for his money in the bigger towns, and he rapidly lost his job. By the turn of the century, there were streetcars in Moorhead, St. Cloud, Mankato, Winona, and Breckenridge, while the network of rails lengthened in the ever-growing, ever-expanding areas of Minneapolis and St. Paul, clear out to White Bear. You remember the old Wildwood car? The one that went to Stillwater? The other way, out west to Hopkins, out to Lake Minnetonka, where the streetcar boats plied the shimmering water in the summertime. And though the streetcar rattled through the streets and across the country, though it carried millions to their destinations, old Dobbin was still king. Horse and buggy, railroad train, and electric streetcar, a combination that would last 1,000 years or maybe more. So everybody believed. Oh, yes, a few of them... thought that dad-blamed horseless carriage was just a starting to show here and there, But old Dobbin was still king. The buckboard, the buggy, the hay rack, the white-coated sweeper with his cart still swept and swept and swept, intent on his task, and the hoofbeat still clattered on the cobblestones. And also out along the rutted roads, the sound of galloping still heard down our country lanes. Few realized it then, but one of Minnesota's milestones, the horse and buggy era, was drawing to a close. A golden, glorious, wonderful era that will live long in the memory of men. I think anyone familiar with the history of Minnesota can't help being impressed with our people's record of thrift. And of course, it's natural that a hardy, vigorous people who believe in being self-sufficient should in turn be thrifty. For thrift, the practice of regular saving, is the surest way to self-sufficiency, to personal and family independence. Twin City Federal is proud to have had a part in helping Minnesota families achieve the security and happiness that go with sound, growing savings accounts. Thousands and thousands of Minnesota families choose to place their savings with Twin City Federal. And they do so for many reasons, of course. And one of them, surely, is safety. Accounts at Twin City Federal are insured for safety by the Federal Savings and Loan Insurance Corporation, a permanent agency of the United States government. You're warmly invited to enjoy progress toward your personal and family independence. Progress through saving at Twin City Federal. A fairly safe place to save, where the twin clock flashes the time and the temperature in downtown St. Paul and Minneapolis. We continue with our story of transportation in Minnesota. Say, Dave, an old man, what's the first car you can remember?
Well, I'll tell you, Father Time. It was the Apperson Jackrabbit made in Kokomo, Indiana. It was purchased by my Uncle Tom, who lived in Anderson, Indiana, and this was back in 1915. It had a jackrabbit emblem about 1 foot long on the radiator grill. And over the weekend, he'd jack it up 3 inches from the floor. That saved the tires, he used to say. And since you've made a point of making me bare my age right here before all these people, Cedric, I'd like to ask you the same question. What is the first car you remember?
Well, Robert, really there's no reason for you to be so sensitive about your old age. The first car I can remember was way back in 1905. A brush it was, a two-seater, painted a brilliant red. My father came home with it one day back in the old hometown of Magnolia. As I remember, it was a two-cylinder job with a double-chain drive. It made a terrific noise, not too powerful in the mud, but it was a sensation wherever it appeared among people and horses. Old Dobbin and the people who rode him and drove him and cleaned up after him didn't know it, but Dobbin was really a dead pigeon. Back there in the 1890s and the early 1900s, the horseless carriage began showing up, just a few at first. They clattered and they chugged and they rattled and they banged and they spit and they coughed and they backslided.
How do you like this car? What did you say?
Conversation was next to impossible, but in spite of all the noise, the gasoline buggy kept coming. By 1902, there were 11 cars in Minneapolis, and that same year, the age of reckless driving began.
Hey, you! In the gasoline buggy?
Yes, sir?
Pull over to the curb.
Now, where do you think you're going at that breakneck pace?
But, officer, I was only doing 11 miles an hour.
If you were driving a horse as you should be, then you'd be apt to know on the speed limit in this town is 10 miles per hour.
And that's how one Tom Shevlin, driving a French-made car, received the first traffic ticket and then paid a $10 fine for exceeding the speed limit in Minneapolis way back in 1902. That same summer, believe it or not, three men arrived in the Twin Cities by car from far-off Chicago, And they made it in the incredible time of 6 days. They bought stove fuel at 9 cents a gallon at general stores along the way.
And here's a little touch, Cedric. It was on May 30th, 1901, that Shakopee, Minnesota, saw its first horseless carriage. A bush it was. The whole town turned out en masse. Everybody, that is, except the village fathers. They were meeting that same day, refused to be disturbed over the newfangled and obviously short-lived contraption. They voted $150 to build a bicycle path to Bloomington.
And there blossomed, too, the age of goggles and linen dusters. For the men, of course, and for the women, hats of colossal width with veils to protect them from the dust and the wind of open car driving.
The early day motorist, remember, was hemmed in by rules on every side. Speed limits 5 to 10 miles per hour, noise restrictions, Sabbath restrictions, license troubles, and oddball traffic rules designed by police right on the spot.
Each operator of a motor vehicle, upon encountering a horse-drawn vehicle, shall come to a full and complete stop. An operator of aforesaid motor vehicle shall turn off motor of said motor vehicle until such time as the aforesaid horse-drawn vehicle has passed from view.
There was even a law on the books which said that a car proceeding through a heavily populated area must be preceded by a man on foot waving a red flag. And you know, Bob, we even have some remnants of those laws today. We run into them every now and then. And here's the part we can remember, Robert. The get out and get under part. Old Tin Lizzy, old Leapin' Lena, just didn't want to leap sometimes. And that led to this little scene. Remember?
Hey, mister, you ain't having trouble with that there contraption, be ya? Be smart, mister. Get a horse. Ha, 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 ha. Get up, Nelly.
And Frederick, remember all the tools you had to cart along in those days?
Yes, and even if you kept the gasoline buggy going, you were in trouble once you left your own community where you knew the roads. Here's a little sample published by the State Automobile Association back in 1911. Instructions on how to get from Owatonna to Dubuque. To get there, you did just exactly what the book said. From Owatonna, follow Owatonna Road to Pratt. From Pratt, follow the main traveled road to the Red Barn. Take a left fork along the old stage road. Keep on the road through Lansing to Austin. Turn in on the road marked by Hub Department Store sign to Rose Creek. Follow Main Road south to Frank. Go straight through Leroy to Chester, following the Milwaukee tracks to Bon Air to Cresco. Take the road turning right from Potavin. Follow that 6.5 miles south, 4 miles east, 2 miles south, and 6 miles east to Lawler. Many of those roads are sandy and full of holes, so great care must be taken at this point, as roads are intersected and forked, and directions must be asked. You know, Robert, I don't think we can get there from here.
Impossible.
Yeah.
And by 1918, everybody knew it. Everybody except the old diehards, that is. The horse and buggy era was dead, gone forever. A world crumbled and fell into the dust. And then a new world arose. A bigger world, a gigantic world. Its symbols, speed of endless ribbons of concrete and asphalt.
Now, wait a minute there, Robert. We have the story of Charlie Babcock. Do you remember him?
The former highway commissioner?
Yes, that's the man. Charles M. Babcock. An Elk River storekeeper he was back in the early 1900s. Charlie Babcock was a good deal more visionary than most folks then. Besides, bad roads were hitting him where it hurt, right in his bank account. So Babcock campaigned for Sherburne County Commissioner.
And regardless of how they tell you, don't you believe them, my friends, when they tell you that the horseless carriage isn't here to stay. I foresee the day when every man, every family will own a motor car. Your vote for me for county commissioner in this election will be a vote for better roads, paved roads, all-weather roads from the farm into the town.
And Babcock won the election.
Oh, he certainly did. Then in 1917, the legislature made Babcock our first highway commissioner. When he left office in 1933, Minnesota had a 7,000-mile trunk highway system, 1,400 miles of paved secondary roads, 36,000 miles of graveled or surface roads. He initiated a highway numbering system. And during his administration, back in 1929, the Minnesota Highway Patrol was established. There, indeed, is a name you should remember. Charles M. Babcock, father of the Minnesota highway system. We're back now to 1914, the rattletrap era, and the scene is northern Minnesota, Hibbing. A diamond drill operator named Carl Wickman grew tired of his job in the mines, and a blacksmith's helper named Andrew Anderson became weary of lifting the sledge.
Oh, what a headache. Sometimes I think my head split right open. Clang, clang, clang. Hey, don't want no more clang, Carl. I like to mess around with these here motor car things.
I'll tell you something, Andy. Drilling ain't no prize either. That's what I want to talk to you about. Now, I got an idea. Why don't we go into the jitney business?
Jitney? What's jitney?
Well, it's a business, a sort of hauling business. A stagecoach using motor cars.
So, go into business they did. And from that beginning grew the giant of the nation. It's buses and scenic cruisers, familiar everywhere. Greyhound bus lines. Now, there are 12 bus lines operating in Minnesota with annual revenues exceeding $100 million. And right along with the buses came the equally huge trucking industry. Many of the largest firms today started after World War I as one truck outfits, with the owner serving as driver, mechanic, salesman, and even office boy. Some, like Murphy Motor Freight, began even earlier as drayage lines. Hennepin Transportation Company was organized back in 1918, when a 50-mile trip was indeed a long haul. Glendenning Motorways was founded in 1924 by Gordon Glendenning, who was working his way through college. And this you may not know, may scarcely believe, but it's true. Today, more than 100 common carriers operate out of St. Paul and Minneapolis every day. And the Twin Cities area is the third largest truck terminal center in the entire United States. The grand total, 100,000 trucks in use by commercial firms. One-third of Minnesota's more than 2,000 communities are solely dependent on trucks for their freight hauling. A giant industry in the automobile era.
And now we face a new future in the motor age. A future so fast that no man 50 years ago could have envisioned the developments that are to come. The bulldozer, the grader, the heavy tractor sound. Detour signs would be thicker than bugs in fly time. But by 1975, a network of federal interstate freeways costing $732 million in Minnesota alone, a nonstop network of highways covering 890 miles in Minnesota, will reach north, south, east, and west. And this is the freeway era, the high-speed era, the step on it and get there era. Its trademark will be twin ribbons of pavement carving wide gaps through the cities, stretching across our farmlands, through forests, to our lakes and beyond, across or rolling under 1,000 bridges. These are the superways that will serve a vast Twin Cities metropolitan complex of the future, stretching unbroken from the St. Croix to Minnetonka, from Rosemont to Forest Lake, one huge city. They will bring farm and city ever closer, the small town scarcely more than around the corner, the lake to your very front door. 20 million people, 10 million cars and trucks and buses. There's your future the next 100 years. Minnesota, 2058.
Community is nothing more or less than a record of people's hopes and dreams, and whether or not they attain them. And any history will show that hopes and dreams never get very far unless they're combined with some kind of action. If we narrow that truth down to our own personal lives, I think we can agree that thrift is a perfect form of action to bring personal hopes and dreams to fulfillment. Yes, for the home you may want, for the new car you may want, for your youngster's education, for business opportunity, for a retirement fund, for security. Start saving and save regularly at Twin City Federal. The current dividend rate is 3.5% compounded quarterly, and that is the top rate in town on insured savings. And you can benefit by this top rate wherever you may live. People from all over our whole area do so by saving by mail at Twin City Federal. For full information, write to me, Cedric Adams, here at WCCO, St. Paul or Minneapolis. Simply ask for details of Twin City Federal's Save by Mail plan. And friend, do it soon, will you? And now our transportation story enters the air age. One day it came, the funny, frail, single-motor biplane zooming low over the county fairgrounds. The dawn of the air age. And they did barrel rolls and loops and outside loops, these men who had no thought for paid-up insurance. And on the grounds, the crowd gawked and old and odd and wondered. Yes, Minnesota became aware of the airplane in World War I. Some of its sons were aviators in the famed Lafayette Escadrille over there in France. The planes showed up in the skies in the early 20s here in Minnesota. The favorite stunt, diving with a zooming, heart-stopping roar under the high bridge in St. Paul. Charles Speed Holman did that and more. He barnstormed around the countryside, thrilling the customers at the county fairs, flying upside down before the grandstand a few hundred feet off the ground. And that's how, in 1931, his Laird biplane roaring, one of Minnesota's air pioneers, met his untimely end.